It's obvious that when these two team up, the result is magical.
This Week in Tennis.
And we brought this dynamic duo together once again.
Welcome to This Week in Tennis.
Hey, Craig, I wonder if anybody missed us.
Judging by the size of your inbox, they probably did.
Oh, yeah, they did. Welcome to This Week in Tennis. I'm Phil Nasons. He's Craig Doyle. We've been doing this show for so many years, I lost track on how many. I think we started the show, I did anyway, in 2007. It is now 2023. We took an extended break thanks to my health issues, but we're back, and Rafael Nadal has decided to forego the French Open and then retire at the end of next year. No surprise.
Yeah, I mean, he's 37 now.
Right.
Which is, it's getting on a bit. Well, people will point and say that Roger Federer played until he was around 40, but the injuries took their toll on him, and he played a very low-impact style of tennis compared to what Rafael Nadal plays. He was not a baseline defensive running player like Nadal is, so the injuries were eventually going to catch up to Nadal, and he's had quite a few of those over the years. He's managed it pretty well. And it looks like he's going to get to go out on his terms. He's going to do that retirement tour. He's going to make a lot of money on this because he's going to go around all the tournaments that he's played. He's going to go there. He's going to draw a big crowd. All the tournaments are going to love that. The ATP Tour and the Grand Slams are going to love that. He's going to be on the big courts, drawing the big money. But I'm sure he'll play some big exhibitions as well.
Well, I would think so. That's probably what he'll do. More than likely with Federer. You know how much money those two will make together for years to come. And probably Djokovic won't get invited, right?
Probably not. I mean, Djokovic, when he retires, I'm sure he'll be knocking on the door of these people looking to set up some exhibitions in far-flung places where he thinks he can draw money. But at the moment, I think you're right that the biggest draw in tennis, and this is quite embarrassing for the ATP and WTA tours, but the biggest draw in tennis is still Federer versus Nadal.
Yep.
One of these guys is retired and the other guy's injured.
And that's all people talk about, too. Nadal and Federer. It is what it is. You know, what a great career. I'm stunned, to be honest. I didn't think he would ever say anything. I think I actually assumed that he would do a Sampras and just walk off the court and that's it. And you just don't see him again. But maybe he wants that fanfare. Or maybe he's telling you he's not coming back.
Is it difficult, more difficult to do that now than when Sampras left, though? When Sampras left, there wasn't quite the same level of media interest. There wasn't the same social media. I don't think there was as much pressure to communicate back to the fan base when Sampras left. And I like the way Sampras left, by the way. Just walk off the court and into the sunset. I'm a really big fan of that. But I think this is different times, and this is a guy who's won 20-odd Grand Slams, probably been the best clay court player you've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this retirement tour thing is the right idea? I think, like, there's a few players have done this, but not anyone on this level, maybe?
I think he'll probably take it on to another level. He's probably, next to Roger Federer, the most beloved player on tour. He's also probably one of the nicest people on tour. And I think that the people will show out, and maybe he wants that. But at the end of the day, he's no longer playing. And he won't play the rest of this year. Again, I would think that moving on will be easy for him. You can see, you know, he's more happy at home. He's got a child at home. He's happy. And I don't think, to me, he never seemed like the guy that liked all that pomp and circumstance stuff. But maybe, you know, at the Laver Cup last year, he saw the reaction for Federer and he thought, you know what, maybe I deserve that too. And maybe this is my time to be selfish and to take that lap, or be unselfish and take that lap for the fans. You know, he's one of the very few superstars, if you will, that you can actually walk up to while he's having dinner. And he'll sit and hang out with you. He'll invite you to join him. I mean, that's just who he is. He's going to be missed. I love the way he played. You know, I was so wrong about him. I saw him play when he was like 14 or 15, I guess. No, 14 maybe. And I thought, clay quarter only. That's it. He's never going to win anything else, but he might be pretty good on clay. And I was wrong because he's won them all, right? He's won all four majors.
Well, were you wrong, though? Because at the time you saw him when he was 14, when you saw a clay court player at that age, they at that time, in that generation, they didn't win matches on hard courts or grass. That None. Didn't happen. That's changed over the last 20 years. People now win. You know, a clay courter can come out there and they can adapt their game and they can play on the hard courts and they can, some of them can play on the grass. And it works the same way around. Guys who can play on the hard courts can now play a little bit more on the clay. So I think, like, to be wrong at that time is perfectly fine. I don't think too many people thought that at early 2000s, maybe before 2000, if you were looking at the tour, you wouldn't have said, oh yeah, that guy's going to win a Grand Slam. He's going to go and win all four slams in his career. He just didn't think like that because the surfaces were so different and there were so many people specialized in playing on one surface. So when you see a young Rafa coming up, you're like, this guy's incredible on the clay, but he ain't got no chance of winning at Wimbledon. Yeah, that 10 years later, that was a different scenario. It's hard to explain to some people who watch the game today how different it was back then.
That's true, and that's what I was basing it on. I'll still own the wrong. I appreciate you bailing me out. But you know what? When I looked at him, I saw that buggy whip forehand. But the one thing that I noticed that stood out, I was standing next to his uncle, and I said, Jesus, that boy doesn't stop. He goes after every little ball. And there weren't any lines people or anyone there. And he had some calls for sure go his way. He just turned around, went back, and did his thing. And I appreciated that part of it. The best part, though, was after his match, and I'm still with his uncle, just standing there, and he came over, and his uncle said, introduce yourself to this coach. And the way he shook my hand and looked at me, eye to eye, that's respect. And that's something that you don't see a whole lot of today. But back then, when he was coming up, like you said, there was still Sampras out there. There was still a serve and volley. There was still like contrary styles of play, if you remember. Now it's pretty much all the same. And that's why they can adapt so much easier, because they don't have to worry about serving and volleying on grass. Because look at the tread marks. Look at the grass, how the brown changed. Remember when I was a kid growing up watching Breakfast at Wimbledon, there was a trail from the baseline to the net, if you remember, right down the middle of the court because guys were serving and volleying. And over the years, you saw that change. And now you rarely see it. You rarely see any brown grass from the service line to the net. So it has changed. But he did come through, didn't he? He won them all. He adapted. He was willing to change and work on his game. His serve got better. And look, we're going to say goodbye to a legend very soon. And he won't be at Roland Garros. Craig and I will be here next week for the preview. But I wish him all the best, Craig. So when we talk about these players, though, without making a lot of effort and maybe not going about things the way Rafael Nadal has done in his career, even since the beginning. And then you see we've got these issues out there, people talking crap about Emma Raducanu, and now you've got coaches coming out and talking about their experiences with her. And I'm wondering, couldn't she learn something from Rafael Nadal?
I'm sure she's had the chance already to learn something from, say, Andy Murray, who during that sort of COVID situation, all of the British players seemed to be quite closely connected via training camps, etc. I'm not sure if she's learned anything from him yet. So it's probably a stretch for her to learn anything from Nadal, but I think probably everyone on tour can learn quite a little bit from Nadal. They can learn how to be a killer for a start. Yeah. And I think there's a lot of people who need to go and learn that aspect of the game. But how to handle themselves on and off the court, I think a lot of people could learn a lot there. How to handle themselves just in general in life. I mean, you never hear a scandal about Nadal in his home life or what he's doing away from the court or which sponsors he's working with this week. He's a very private person away from the court. That's something I guess a lot of people can learn a little bit from. On the court, the work ethic, you've been there countless times, whether it's been at the Open or elsewhere, and you see this guy practicing, there's a lot of people could learn a lot about tennis from the way that guy practices. You just watch the last 5-10 minutes of the practice session. There's something in there that everyone can pick up from and bring into their game. Yeah, I mean, as a role model goes, he's probably the perfect one on the tour for most people. And I think one of the things you probably look at with Nadal that's not mentioned often is that when he was growing up, not a lot of people, as you said earlier on, saw him as this multiple-time Grand Slam champion. He's had to work hard for that. It's not come naturally to him. He doesn't hit a forehand like Federer does, where he can adapt and hit that ball with beautiful spin from anywhere on the court. Nadal's forehands, it's a weapon in its own right, but it's a construct of many years of practice and getting it right. A lot of people don't put in the hours that he puts in. They won't put in the type of practices that he puts in. There's so much that people can learn from this guy. And the other thing, the one thing I've not mentioned, is how to be tough, because I think a lot of people need to learn how to be tough in the same way that he has.
You know what? That's a great point. And we're not picking on Emma Raducanu here, because she's on our topic list, because she's had to deal with some injuries since that historic run. And I remember, you know, we're going to talk about a lot of things that you and I have said over the past 3 or 4 years with this young bunch coming up. We're going to go back and retrace some things, like with Coco Gauff, things that were said on the show that 2 years later, these so-called famous coaches are now starting to see. But with Emma, she's out. She's had a wrist surgery, and I believe she had another surgery on her lower body or something. She's not coming back.
I don't think so.
No.
I've been saying for a while, before any of the evidence of these surgeries was on the table, I've been saying that I don't see her being a long-term prospect. I think it's a lot like Eugenie Bouchard, another player that we feature quite often on this show over the years. Talented? Absolutely. There's no doubt that both of those players are talented. But the off-the-court lifestyle for Raducanu, I think, has been a vast change to what she was used to before that. And it's hard not to become addicted to that, not to be picking up the phone calls, doing the sponsor events, going to the parties. When you've won the big one, everybody wants a piece of you. They want your face on their brand. And she's been brought into that. They've milked the cow, so to speak, on it. I think tennis has taken a bit of a backseat. Some poor coaching decisions have probably been made during that time, especially with her father switching her coach out so often. She's got a bad reputation in the coaching circuits already. People don't really want to work with her because if you're there for 3 months as a coach, your reputation suffers because it looks like you've not been able to satisfy the demands of the player. So it's... For Emma, it's going to be really difficult to come back, I think. And I think there's a lot of people in the Emma Raducanu fan clubs that are a lot like these Djokovic fans, right, in that you're not allowed to criticize Raducanu because she's had success previously. They don't want to see the criticism. So when journalists, you know, I'm talking about serious people here, mm-hmm, who are out there every week on the tour. They're traveling from place to place, bringing the latest news out. When they bring out any sort of news or form some sort of opinion on Raducanu, these people jump all over it. They don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear any sort of negativity. I think we need to start looking at the reality. She won the US Open, and then since then, she's barely been able to put together a winning run of 3 matches in a row. And that's being generous, because there's a lot of weeks where she just doesn't win the first match, or she wins the first match and she loses the second one. That's not a good foundation for the future. This girl's going to be way outside the top 100 when she comes back. And my feeling on this is that she'll come back. She'll get a couple of wild cards to Wimbledon. She maybe get one to the US Open if they're feeling generous. But if she can't perform when she comes back at those events, then I could see her losing interest pretty quickly.
Yeah, you know, you talk about the coaching carousel. You know, 3 months, you can't do doodle with a player. Not really. Not with so many flaws as she has. You know, granted, she won the U.S. Open, but I'm going to give you a little tip from some of the gals I know on the WTA Tour. I'm going to give you an inside tip. what they did at the U.S. Open with her, because not many people really knew much about her, what they knew is that she crumbled at Wimbledon. She had a meltdown. And prior to that, she had dominated some lower-level events. But what they saw there at Wimbledon, they used at the U.S. Open again. You know, let her wait, hang around, wait for her to miss something, wait for her to miss a short ball killer, and then just watch her crumble. It backfired a bit because it didn't. You know, she made the balls that she was hitting in the backdrop at Wimbledon, for example, and everything came together. And then the next time she stepped on the court, they went right back to that because the players know how, well, how lucky that was. Granted, she's a Grand Slam champion, but let's face it, that fortnight she played out of her mind. God bless her. She couldn't miss. And then she went right back to who she was as soon as she left New York. I don't think that has to do with money. That's just who she is. She's a top 150 player. She's not a top star. There's not a single person who tabbed her as a junior to win anything. Just compete. Because she only played junior tennis part-time, Craig. She's never played a full schedule of tennis anywhere ever. And the demands on the pro tour, the body you have to have, for the punishment that you go through, and ladies, they go through it worse because they have, you know, female issues, right? And those things are a drawback as well. And now you take this young kid who just became famous for basically making all her dreams come true, and even deep down she knows it. That's why she walks around the locker room pumped out with her chest out. She's only there for the first day of the tournament usually, but she makes it well known that she's won a Grand Slam. And that's just who she is. But the players all knew. The coaches knew. Even her first coach who took her to the U.S. Open and where she won knew. You know, he had a plan to take a step back, if you remember. But that wasn't good enough for her parents. And now she is where she is. And I feel bad for her in a way. But then again, I don't. She's got generational wealth for 3 hot weeks. She's not coming back, bro.
I don't think so. I really don't. I think it's going to be limited to the British grass court season when she does come back. And then she might get that wild card at the US Open. I don't see her going on lower level tournaments after that. I think she might, if there's some sort of success, either at Wimbledon or the US Open, let's say she gets to the second week or something like that, she might reappear the next year, try and do something. She'll always have that wild card for LTA events, whether it's the Wimbledon or grass court events before then. And she might play a couple of years in that sort of environment. But I don't see her coming back full time in the same way that Eugenie Bouchard hasn't really come back full time. She's been way down the rankings. She's never managed to put the consistency together. It's the same situation. There's patterns of this over the years. You and I have seen this over the last 10, 20 years. There are players who appear, they do very well, and they disappear entirely. It's tennis, unfortunately.
Yep.
Some people don't like it. But you could list loads of names. You know, you could talk about your Safinas, you can talk about your Zvonarevas, your Bouchards. A lot of these players have risen up the rankings and then just fallen again. And by fallen, I mean they don't go down to 20 or 30 in the rankings. It's tough to stay at 20 or 30 on the women's tour. These players come up, they hit number one, number two, number three in the world, and then they just disappear into the hundreds again within the space of anything from a year to 18 months. So it is what it is. It's probably going to be what we see again.
Yep, it's the money. The top players make so much money that they just don't seem to go all out when it really matters. I've seen guys now tanking at Masters events. I don't understand it. This one didn't tank, but he's in the tank. FAA Felix Auger-Aliassime. He's dropped 3 straight. He's looked awful. He's gotten to the third set against Popperin, lost. Got to the third set against Lahovic, lost. Sarandulo smacked him real good. Let's see. He did beat Monteiro, but that took him two tiebreakers to do. And then he got stomped by Alcaraz in the Indian Wells Masters. He has not played well. And I think that what we're seeing from him is the same as we're seeing basically from Emma Raducanu minus a Grand Slam. We saw a guy who just maxed out.
I think that's a fair point, actually. I like this guy. I thought he looked like Monfils. I liked Monfils when he first came on the scene. But after you watch for a while, he doesn't evolve. He doesn't change. He's not learning. He's got probably one of the best coaching options around, and he's not learning. If that coach can't help him to win some kind of title, then I just think, like, when does he get better? When does he win something? It's probably not going to happen.
Probably not going to happen. But he did give us a good run a couple fortnights ago with the, I believe he got to the finals of the U.S. Open, correct?
Yeah, I think, like, hard court tennis is definitely more suited to him than the clay.
Yes, he's quick. You know, like...
He's quick and he hits a big ball as well from the back of the court. He does have, like, a lot of power. I think that's where I sort of likened him to Monfils, in that he can stand at the back of the court and he can hit a huge bomb. But I think he's got a little bit more variety than Monfils. He's not going to run back and forth at the back of the court all the time. So there's maybe something there. It's just... He doesn't look like he's going to finish off a top player. He looks like he'll win the match if he's playing well. But if he's not playing well, I don't see how he battles back and hangs in there and takes people in their tie break and steals a set. I'm struggling to see that with this guy. It's nice, but it's not winning tennis.
It's hard to beat the top players when you can't beat the ones that aren't. He's struggling because, you know, And everything that you say about him is absolutely correct, too. What a good athlete. I think Monfils is a better athlete than FAA. I really do. But I think that this FAA, he's got some real skills. That he's hit some bombs, like you say, from damn near the backdrop. That's 21 feet from the baseline. And just crushing balls. And that's a beautiful thing. But for whatever reason, he just doesn't or hasn't since that great run put it all, you know, maintain that, if you will. And granted, top 10 in the world's not so bad. Getting to a Grand Slam final is a beautiful thing. But when you see a player like him with all this ability, he has some charisma. He's great in the press room. So, I mean, he's got all these things. You don't hear anything about scandals. If you remember the year he got to the finals of the U.S. Open, what did he do? He traveled with his sister, if you remember, for the whole year. Maybe he needs to go back to that. Because traveling with the girlfriend maybe ain't doing him any favors. Who knows? But I hope that he comes through. I do. I just don't see it. Because like we've seen so often, as players get to this point, they get there, they get some big money, more endorsements, more distractions in their life. And, you know, it is what it is. It's a pity, right? Because that kid can play. Now, I'm not saying that he won't win. I just don't think he will win. I hope he wins because it would be nice to see someone else win a major for a change.
Well, you're going to see plenty more winners shortly. there's not much. I guess this is the topic on the list that's coming up as well, but Djokovic isn't playing very well, is he?
Well, Craig, as you know, I guess I might as well spill the beans. Craig and I have had this running conversation in different chat message box and text box and WhatsApp and wherever else for about 12 years. And we picked on Novak this week with Ruin. And that worked out real good. You know, I think the toll of COVID finally with the realization that maybe a lot of people aren't real fond of him personally. I think all of that is starting to take its toll. And I think what he's going to do now is just kind of wait it out, ride it out. Maybe he can eke out another slam or two and go down as the one with the most majors. Because none of these kids underneath him, and that's Alcaraz too, are ever going to catch him. Or Nadal or Federer. different players, Craig.
Yeah, I mean, I thought there might be something in Alcaraz. He seems to be struggling a little bit with the injury thing at the minute, but it's difficult to see anybody coming along and consistently winning that number of Grand Slams over a period of time, not just when they're in their early 20s, but into their 30s. If you win one a year over your career, you win 12. So that kind of puts into perspective what most of these guys have done and their longevity as well. You go back to like 2005 when Rafa won his first one. It's, we're almost 20 years ago. Most people don't last 20 years on the tour. That's crazy talk. Most people get 12 years out of their career, maybe 15 if they've got a really injury-free time. And then you're looking at saying, oh, you're probably going to have to win most years, win two slams. That's a big ask. That's complete domination.
That is. And you know what? With a minus a lack of killer instinct and just basically being a killer, because what we witnessed over the last 20 years, and well, yeah, 20, because what if Sampras won the 2002 U.S. Open? We'll start there. Because that's basically where the guard kind of shifted, right? So you go back and you look at this, and we only seen about three or four killers out there, right? You've got Federer, absolute killer. If you think Nadal ain't a killer, you better forget it. Djokovic, sometimes he's a killer. Andy Murray, total killer. And he's out there with a steel rod in his hip. Or maybe two now, right? Let's see. You know who I liked a lot, who I thought was a killer? Juan Martín Del Potro. He was another one with that big ball, remember? He's another guy who could hit the ball from the backdrop and hit a winner past you at the net. I mean, he was this big hitter. I liked him a lot. Leighton Hewitt was a killer. Let's see. Who else was another one that we can think of from the men's side, Craig? Who did you like? Who did you think? Did you think that Marin Cilic was a killer at one time?
I think he could have had the potential to be. He probably didn't maximize on his talent. I think he had all the assets. He had the physicality. He had the height. He probably could have got more out of his career than he did. I'd like to probably nominate Stan Wawrinka in the second half of his career.
Yeah, I was thinking of that too.
You know, that guy could have been a top 20 player and never won a slam. And then he woke up one morning and said, I better win something before my career's over. And then he won three.
That's right. You know, he's an interesting tale. Because he was
dude's ice cold.
Yeah, right? Because remember, hey, do you remember when there was a time that he hated Federer, remember? Because he was in Federer's shadow. And Wawrinka was quietly moving up through the ranks. But you're right. He found his chance. And he took advantage of it. Yeah, he was a killer at one point, too. You know who's not a killer, though, I don't think? Is Coco Gauff. I don't think she's a killer at all.
No, and I think you probably were the first person I can think of who started picking the flaws in the game. And there's technical flaws in that game that make it difficult for her, but I don't think she's found a way to solve those technical problems. And people are still talking about the same Coco Gauff that they saw at 15 years old that had potential. But unfortunately, she's not 15 anymore. And a lot of people are looking at her and saying, I don't see where she wins a slam. The stars really now need to align for her to win a slam. She's probably looking at the likes of Iga Swiatek, and a few other players in there, maybe Sabalenka, the likes of her, getting injured, because I don't think in a big match that Coco Gauff actually beats one of these players.
You know, you might be right. We talked a lot about that forehand. I thought that was the thing that she really needed to work on. You know, I it's hard to second guess people. I know her parents had a lot to do with her success, but turning her pro that young, with all those flaws against professional tennis players, that just doesn't fly. That's not smart. You know, I think the recommendation I made was to take a step back, play juniors, and work on that forehand. You have to rebuild that forehand. There's too much going on in that backswing. If you ever watch her, and her forehand is never the same twice. It's just not good. And that's why she misses those. You rarely see a lady in the top 10 without a big forehand, right? Świątek, forehand. Sabalenka, she'll hit it. She either break the court or the backdrop, but she's got one. Rybakina, she's got one. Ons Jabeur, she'll slap that forehand past you quicker. You won't even see it. Pegula, she got a slapper too, right? Bencic, slapper. Simona Halep, she got one too. Sakkari, she got one too. Kitova, she's got a $1 million one. And you have Coco Gauff, who's like the Dollar Tree version of the forehand. And that just doesn't make sense. And that didn't have to be, by the way. All they needed to do was take a step back and shorten that swing, take a year off, you know, and come out there and massacre people. Fix that forehand. Then you fix the serve. Then you, well, I got that mixed up. The first thing I said, fix the body language. You're awful. Second of all, fix that forehand. That's ridiculous. Outside of clay, you're never going to get around on a real hitter. And the third thing, now fix the serve. And if they would have taken a step back while she was a junior when not many were talking about her, as opposed to trying to do it after she's in the top 10, that ain't going to fly because that money train is going to get interrupted now for real. And she's going to fall down the rankings to fix it. So it's better to just stay in the top 10, become an activist, and now you've got an excuse.
So you'll not be coming on the show next week and picking Coco Gauff to win Roland Garros?
Oh, no, I might, because that's the only one I think she can win with that forehand, because the ball slows down for her, and as you saw, she got to a final because of that, right? So maybe she gets that same luck again. Maybe she gets, that's where she's going to do it, because she just doesn't have the proper mechanics on the forehand. She's got a junior forehand, okay? Big backswing, a lot of loop. You know how they used to teach that? You got to loop it. You know, I used to look at coaches and I said, don't you coach for the next 20 years? Because in 20 years' time, that loop ain't going to work. I started using everybody. Every single kid I ever coached from the time 2000 on were short backswings because the game's too fast now. You don't have a whole lot of time. These kids hit the ball hard. These strings are like slingshots. The rackets, the frames, unbelievable, the equipment. She never took advantage of that. But she's made a lot of money, and she's made a nice name for herself. There's no scandals. But the reality is I don't think you can be an activist and a top player in an individual sport. A top number one player, I mean. Because there's no way with the talent that girl has, Craig, that she shouldn't be in the top five consistently and be reaching a lot more finals than just the Roland Garros.
Well, no, you can't be an activist and be fully engaged in what you need to do to be winning every other week. You need to be fully committed to the sport that you're playing. The training aspect, the video analysis aspect, where you sit down and you watch the tapes of other people playing and you figure out with your coaches how you're going to beat them. You really need to be working in the gym, physically preparing yourself, mentally preparing yourself. There's a lot of things going to being the best at tennis. When you look at the last 20 years, and particularly in the women's game, actually, there's not been anyone better than Serena Williams, because Serena Williams has probably been the most committed person to the sport. She didn't have the distractions that Sharapova had. And let's not get ourselves wrong. Sharapova was a good player. She won 5 slams. She's won at each of the 4 Grand Slams. But she had a lot of off-the-court business interests, sponsorship deals, etc., etc. You look at her record against someone like Williams, who was dedicated to the sport, committed to the sport, then it's incomparable. She couldn't win against Williams. She struggled to win matches against Williams. She got completely dominated. And when you talk about activism with Gauff or wokeism with Osaka or whatever it is that she's into these days, You know, Osaka's won slams, but she's not going to be Serena Williams. She's not going to be at the top of the game for a long time because she's got all of these interests outside of the court that takes up her time, and her mental capacity to play tennis is diverted to these other things that she's gotten herself involved with. And I'm sure Osaka's not bothered. She's made a lot of money with some of the ventures that she's already had. She doesn't have to play tennis again. But if you want to be that top player for 15 years or even for a decade, then you've really got to knuckle down and play tennis. And I don't think that's going to happen with Gauff. And for the USTA and American fans who were hopeful that they were going to see this new star rise to the top, I think she might be a top 10 or top 20 player long term, but I don't think she's going to be the one that's going to come away at the end of her career with 10 slams. But I could be wrong.
You could be. I don't think you are. I'm glad you brought up Serena. This is all Serena and Venus's fault. Actually, it's Richard Williams' fault. All of this is. And I'm going to make a controversial take. And you know how I feel about those two girls. I watched them play when they were little kids. And I think the world of them. And I get along nice with Richard. But I got to tell you, he made a big mistake. Well, he didn't. Everyone else around him did. Everyone was watching how Serena and Venus came up, and they thought they could train their kids the same damn way. You know what? They thought because Richard said, you're going to go to school, girl. You're going to go do this. You're going to do that, right? See, everyone thought that they could do the same thing. But here's where Richard Williams had the wild card and why Serena is the greatest ever. Because all those little distractions like art school, you know, he had them doing a lot of things to be more well-rounded. He wanted them to be well-rounded individuals besides being the number one player in the world, and I think they accomplished that. But then at the end of the day, you've got folks like Coco Gauff's parents who are just club pro teachers. You know, that's all they are, club pros. And that's a great thing. We need those, by the way. I was a club pro for about 10 minutes, and I couldn't handle it. I like being at the resorts better for obvious reasons, more money, less people on my back, and more fun. But Serena had Venus Williams to practice with, okay? Venus has Serena to practice with. And don't forget, Venus got all the coaching first from the real coaches. So all that kind of rubbed off, and they were learning from real, real tennis people like Cohen over there in California, Ricky Maechi, those fellas. Who did Coco Gauff learn from? She learned from her mother and father, and it's not changed. And you know what? Until that does, maybe she's getting some help from some others, but you can't do anything with that because the forehand's not there. I know her coach knows this. I know her parents should have known this. But that's why she has the problem she has. Because everyone tried to be like Serena and Venus. But they missed the ingredient. They both had top players to hit with from the time they were little. Each other. That's where they've made their mistake. I wish Coco all the best. 10 Grand Slams? I would love to see that, Craig. I don't think it's going to happen, though. Just don't.
Oh, you would just love to see her win one, but there's an opportunity for that because even Sloane Stephens managed to win the Open once.
Well, there you go. You know, this is kind of funny. Sloane Stephens, until she won that major, was 100% totally focused, remember? And then she kind of got sidetracked, and rightly so. But she's a lot different now, if you notice. We don't see these things like we saw before where she would basically put a racket in the bag and just walk through the match when things weren't going her way. She's trying a little more. Probably because she's married now. Life is a lot more stable. Her husband does pretty well, too. So she doesn't have any real worries. And she can go out and play. And every so often, she's going to surprise you. But you know what surprised me? And it's been 1 year, Craig, since I ruptured my Achilles. 1 year.
You're doing pretty good.
Yeah, how about that? I'm walking now, at least. The tennis is over, and that's okay. Oh, and I have to make this announcement, by the way, on this show. I am working for Rebecca Media, and one of the things that I'm doing sports betting writing, and I'll be covering the French Open and Wimbledon at ilbetting.com, and you'll have the a tournament preview there on both sides of the draw. You'll have some betting advice from the book that'll be published in September called Betting Tennis 101. And it'll be a good time. And you're going to have this show next week. And we're going to bust it down like only we do. We're going to have a lot of fun. But I've been watching a lot of tennis, Craig, because, you know, I can't do a whole hell of a lot. It's been a long grind. It takes a couple of years to come back from this. But I've been watching a lot of tennis, a lot of WTA events. What is up with all these bagels?
You tell me. I mean, you're the man with betting experience, so I'll leave the floor to you.
Oh, thank you. You know what? There's a couple schools of thought. I think one of them was maybe the girls are unfair about the prize money and they're playing splits. You know, a split being one of those situations where they do it at an exhibition. They used to do it. The men used to do it in the finals of smaller events because, you know, the disparity between the champion's prize and the runner-up. What they used to do is pool the money. The players make a deal. We'll play at an exhibition. First set, whoever wins the first set, the other guy wins the second. We play for real the third. We split the prize money, and then the loser pays the taxes. That's what I thought was going on, but I don't think that's the case now. I think what you're seeing now is more about what you see in all spectrums of life. You see the, okay, it's not going well, I'll stop, and then I'll try again. You know, the other day, well, you saw, you and, like I said, I said before, we play and talk about tennis, you and I, nonstop for 100 freaking years. We talk about betting on tennis and how to make more money, and you and I have done damn well for ourselves because of it. And I cherish that, by the way. I appreciated it last time you said to me, hey, watch Norrie, see what you think. And what did we do? We nailed a 350 dog, didn't we? See, it's a great team. Craig has one of the best eyes I've ever seen. For a guy who never played tennis at the higher levels or really a lot of levels, he's a really good hitter. He knows, he's got a better eye than most coaches. And we've been able to do that. But these bagels, I think it really comes down to this, Craig. I think if someone wins the first set and things don't go the way they think they should right away, they just kind of pack it in and go win the third. I don't think they're trying to setting anything up beforehand now. I used to. I just think they just give up and play again. Now, if you've won the first or lost the first set, obviously, if things aren't going well, you got to fight a little bit or else you're out. But that third set is like their insurance marker, and they use that. That's why you're seeing all these bagels, like the Taylor Townsend match last week. You remember that, Craig? I had the over. Do you remember? Three sets that damn match went. And it barely got to 22 games. That's 18 freaking games minimum that you have to win in three sets to win a match, a full match. You telling me they won four games between them and three? The losing player won four games between them over three sets. What the freak?
Well, welcome to women's tennis. I mean, you see it much more on the women's side than you do the men's side. And I do wonder, like, particularly with the clay and the amount of effort you've got to put in. You don't get a lot of cheap winners on the clay.
No.
Unless someone's playing really badly. If you serve, expect the ball to come back. If you hit a big forehand, expect the ball to come back. I do sometimes wonder if somebody goes a break behind and they don't instantly get that break back, if they think, yeah, you know, I'll wait till the next set.
That's
because
what
It's such an energy expenditure. You look at the number of weeks of clay court tennis as well. We've been playing clay court tennis since the start of April, effectively.
Yeah.
We came away from Miami, and a lot of these players were straight into clay on the men's side, whether that was like Monte Carlo or Barcelona. Then we've had Madrid, Rome. We're going to have another week. Then we're going to have Roland Garros. It's a lot of weeks on the clay. It's an accumulation of a lot of time on the court. I think a lot of these players really just look at it and think, okay, I'm a break down here. I'm already three love down. That set's probably gone. I'm not going to expend my energy on trying to chase down every ball when the chances of me getting back into the set now are pretty slim. On a hard court, you can do that because you might be able to hit two or three winners. Plenty of rallies on the hard court are going to go less than four or six shots. So if somebody serves it up, you get the return in, they play a ball back, and you go for a winner. It's feasible that you could get cheap points that way, you get quick points on the board that way. You don't tend to see that in clay. You're seeing 20 and 30 sort of rallies over and over. And I have to admit, there's not a lot of people got the conditioning for that, especially after you've already played maybe 3-4 weeks of clay court tennis. You're well into the season. You don't want to expend yourself, particularly with Roland Garros on the horizon, where the big prize money is going to come out. Why would you go running back and forth for a second round match at a, I'm not even talking about a Masters event, you know, it might be a 500 or 250. Yeah, you know, I could see the logic. If you want to play for 3.5 hours in a second round match, you don't want to do that when you've got Roland Garros coming up. You want to save your energy for the big one. If you get to the fourth round there or something, you're going to make some big cash. For a lot of players, that's that could define their season if they get to the second week at a slam. So, yeah, I kind of follow it. It's a tough pill to swallow, and it's not great for those of us who are playing the over. But, you know, you got lucky the other day, I think.
Oh, yeah.
There are going to be times where it goes 3 sets and you think you're going to win on the over and it ends up on the under and you're just like, wow. And I don't think you're going to see that at Roland Garros because the stakes are bigger, the prize money's bigger, people are there for the big points that they're going to get. So you'll not see people giving up so easily on a set at Roland Garros unless maybe they're 4-love down or 5-1 down. You might see that if they've... But I think that it'll still be closely contested. They'll be losing those games to 40 or to 30. They're not gonna give up and tank a set at Roland Garros. But in the lead up, yeah, I think there's a little bit of caution, and as we've learned,
I've seen these things happen in challenger matches, Craig. I get it. Everything that you said, I understand completely. You know, plus the ladies do have issues. You know, they have that monthly thing they have, you know, their monthly menstrual cycle hits. They do have those issues, but you know what? I've seen these things in challengers, and I've seen in half of those girls, they don't have a shot in hell of even qualifying for a Grand Slam. So I understand what you say, and at the top level, I get it to some degree. But if you're fighting at the challenger level to one day, you know, just get a ranking high enough where you don't have to qualify for a major, I think you should go after it and do it. I mean, laying down is never a good thing, especially when you're coming up. I understand, again, too, why some of these things happen. I totally understand, you know, pacing yourself, you know, why expend that energy. You know, men do this too, but you don't see as many bagels out there. I don't know why that is, but the ladies have a lot of them. And I guess the only real reason I brought it up is because if you're playing totals, you know what you need to do? You need to pray. Go find your priest and tell him, I just bet on Taylor Townsend to go 3 sets. Please don't let her lose the second set 6-love. How do you lose the second set 6-love when you're Taylor Townsend and you're 125 in the freaking world? How do you do that?
You certainly shouldn't.
And that's my whole point. But I did cover they did cover, thank God, because their opponent, you know, stepped on the gas a little bit. But now we have one more thing we were going to talk about today. This is our first show back, so sorry for the rust. It has been a long time. The last time I did a show was with you, Craig.
That must have been quite a while ago.
Well, that was when I was the day after my surgery, remember?
Oh, yeah.
I was a real treat that day.
You were struggling. Yeah, you were struggling.
No, I couldn't even see the freaking screen, but it was I wanted to get the show out.
I do remember that, yeah, that you were like, yeah, I got to stop this for a little bit.
And it's been a year, right?
it has, yeah.
So now let me ask you something. Let's finish this up. Carlos Alcaraz, he's a hell of a player. He's got so much excitement. You know, he brings this level of energy. I love watching him, but my goodness, he got beat the other day. I think that was more of I'm going to Rome. Maybe he already knew Nadal was pulling out. What do you think? He's going to obviously be the odds-on favorite. He's won, holy smokes, he's won 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. He's 12-1 over his last 13 matches. So without Nadal, with a banged up Federer, no Federer, Is he the favorite to win this thing?
I think he is, because like the odds on Nadal were silly, but without Nadal, they'll have to probably re-spread the odds shortly. And I think you were getting like he was the second favorite by a good distance, followed by Djokovic, and then your man
Tsitsipas.
No, Holger Rune.
Oh yeah, of course.
Yeah, we were chatting about him.
He's one of my all-time favorites, that kid.
Yeah, he was. yeah, absolutely. He was a good. He's got really good odds on him. You know, he's like that outside bet that if you don't fancy playing Alcaraz, we'll talk about this next week when we get the official numbers in. But if you don't fancy playing Alcaraz. Holger Rune is probably the one to play. But I think Alcaraz is probably quite rightly the favorite. It will depend on how his conditioning is. Certainly, it's going to be a long 2 weeks. And there's always that nagging doubt in your mind that Djokovic is playing possum a little bit and he's not really trying at the minute. But we can assess that next week. I think you're probably right, though. Alcaraz, he should be the favorite.
And here he is. He's at DraftKings. He is a 125 under or favorite. That's plus money. So that's, if you're reading it, it's plus 125, or we just call it a buck 25. Novak Djokovic is a 2-1, two plus two. Rune's number three, 700.
Yeah.
Tsitsipas,
no,
800.
Yeah, I wouldn't even play that. You could give me 8,000 on Tsitsipas, I wouldn't be playing it.
You really know how to cut a guy, don't you? Yannick Sinner. Yannick, I'm very proud of that young man. Yannick Sinner, 1,300, dude. $1 is going to pay you how much? $1,300 if he wins. Now, how is Daniil Medvedev 2,000?
Well, he doesn't play very well on the clay, although he's played a little bit better this year than he has in previous years.
He's a killer, though.
He is, but you know, at the same time, you've got to win. You've got to win matches on the clay to do that, and he just doesn't play. He just looks clunky on the clay, but that's fine because Andy Murray looked clunky on the clay for a number of years before he figured out. How, you know, he got to a final at Roland Garros as well. So
that young fellas look clunky a lot of times, but that's part of his charm, though. But that's his charm, though, because you know what? When you see him, if you went to a place like in Vegas, Baskin Park, where guys go and hustle, and you know, try to make a few extra bucks or whatever they think they're doing, you see Andy Murray show up, and you don't know he's a pro tennis player. He don't look like one, does he?
No, not really, no.
You're handing your money over to him in about a half hour, too.
Yeah, probably. Quite quickly as well. He'll take you for a ride real quick.
So how is Borna Koric? And you know what? It's really nice to see he's recovered from some of his injuries and issues. 5,000. He's a bigger favorite than FAA, Sebastian Korda, Taylor Fritz, 8,000. He's played pretty good on the dirt. Berrettini, 8,000.
Have you got Casper Ruud on there? He's playing pretty well at the minute.
Yeah, 16.
That's not a bad play. I mean, he's been to the final before.
Oh, yeah. I think he's a good one, too. I think a lot of his father. Look at Sasha Zverev, 3,500. But Koric, 5,000 for real? I wouldn't have him higher than Taylor Fritz or Berrettini. Why is Dominic Thiem even on this? 8,000. Does he even have a high enough record to qualify for this thing? Is he ranked high enough for this?
I don't know. I guess he must be either ranked high enough or he'll get a wild card.
Wawrinka, your man Wawrinka, 13,000. 13,000. Dominic Thiem, who, well, I really feel sorry for him, but Dominic Thiem can't.
Yeah, he's
win.
Ranked 96.
What's the cutoff? 88? 85?
No, the cutoff's usually 100. It's usually top 100. Then after that, it's
That's
qualifiers.
Right. That's right, because then you have your eight wild cards. Wild cards. It used to be that way when I was in my day. It used to be 85 because they didn't have that big a draw, if you remember.
But that's right, yeah, but it made the draw bigger.
Yeah, this is what happens when you're rusty. You forget things. But it's all good. Craig, it's been so much fun doing this show today. Next week, we're going to talk about all the things you need to know about how to bet on the French Open. We'll give you some possible winners. If the French Tennis Federation gets that draw up and out soon enough, we'll maybe even do one of those things, Craig, where we actually go through the draw and make some picks instead of just picking winners without the draw.
We could try that. Yeah, that'll be that'll certainly be a different thing. I think it probably will be out by the time we do this next week.
I would think so. All right, for Craig Doyle, I'm Phil Nasons. We want to thank you, as always, for listening to This Week in Tennis.
This Week in Tennis.